You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of June, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Poppy Trowbridge.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's time for us to set the day's news agenda with the three stories you'll need to know. Alessio Palatano from King's College London, what do you have?
Well, today we have three very interesting stories. The Guardian has a comprehensive interview with Edward Snowden, the whistleblower behind the NSA surveillance revelation. And then we go to Korea, on the Korean peninsula, where the two Koreas agreed senior-level meetings in Seoul. And then lastly, we'll be looking about how young males eye fancy car market in China.
Also on the program is time running out for Turkey's protesters. Prime Minister Erdogan says he's losing patience. We're in Istanbul to find out what happens next.
Could you ditch your BlackBerry and the modern luxuries for 6 months? Well, one man left the city and spent 6 months alone in the wilderness. Did he make it?
Shoveling the snow, drilling the ice, fishing and rumbling around my hut.
Plus, we'll head to Africa to get the latest on Nelson Mandela, who is still in hospital.
All that, plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a busy program up ahead, but before all that, here is David Spencer with the latest world news.
Thank you. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. A former CIA employee has been explaining why he leaked details of a top-secret US surveillance program to the newspapers. 29-year-old whistleblower Edward Snowden said he was acting out of conscience to protect what he called basic liberties for people around the world. He's been working as a contractor at the US National Security Agency and released details of an NSA program codenamed PRISM. Revelations that it was used to gather millions of phone records and monitored internet data have caused concern about intrusion. President Obama's defended the surveillance schemes, saying they're necessary to protect the US from terrorist attacks. But speaking in Hong Kong, Mr. Snowden's told the UK's Guardian newspaper he felt compelled to come forward.
Over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up, and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem. Until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government.
Afghan security forces have fought off a major attack on the international airport in Kabul, which also houses an international military base. Seven militants were killed after a dawn raid in the capital. The first high-level meeting between officials from North and South Korea for 6 years has been announced. The talks are set to take place in Seoul on Wednesday and Thursday. The announcement came after preliminary discussions at the weekend and follows months of tension between the two nations. Officials in Hungary say flood defences put in place over the weekend appear to have held off a surge in the level of the Danube in the capital Budapest. There had been concern about flooding, similar to that seen across much of Central Europe over the last week. At least 15 people have died in the floods. On Sunday, thousands of people were evacuated from parts of eastern Germany after a dam burst. The United States and Jordan have started a military exercise called Eager Tiger, focusing on what's called irregular warfare, as well as terrorism and national security threats. Last week, the US announced it will deploy Patriot anti-aircraft missiles and F-16 fighter jets to the country, drawing swift condemnation from Moscow, which accused the West of sending weapons to fuel Syria's civil war. US Major General Robert Catenanotti insisted training concerned with chemical attacks is not unique to Jordan and nothing to do with any threat of chemical weapons in neighboring Syria.
We trained years ago in the United States, as an example, in small unit. In my time growing up in my military, we all have chemical training from any activity. So we continue to build those objectives into any exercise that we do. So nothing is unique here in Jordan.
Prayers have been said across South Africa for former President Nelson Mandela, who spent a third night in hospital with a recurring lung infection. The 94-year-old was hospitalised early on Saturday. It's his fourth hospital stay since December, and there's been no official update since the government said on Saturday his condition was serious. However, relatives who visited him on Sunday appeared in a positive mood. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. It is 5 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time for us now to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us now in the studio is Alessio Padalano from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Many thanks, Alessio, for coming into the studio.
Good morning.
The story that everyone's really talking about, it's about this whistleblower, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And The Guardian has features this very lengthy interview with him. And I think it's interesting because, we've been hearing a lot over the past few days about the scandal itself, the problems raised by this alleged internet monitoring program. But behind this, there's a human element. There is a sense of, with the emphasis here is really about the reasons why he came out. And I think this moral element is quite intriguing
and
altogether.
Now that we have this face and name and geographical location, and we see this young man with spectacles saying that he knows what he's doing and he knows that he may never go home again, I mean, you really can start to feel the personal element too, can't you?
Absolutely.
You're looking at this story and how his sort of personal story seems to echo the journey of everyone else. I mean, how much do you think he's learned his lessons from what's happened to Bradley Manning, a previous whistleblower now facing trial?
Well, I think this is a part of the sort of moral tension that he was living, at least from the interview, what one gathers is this idea, this was a young man who literally started growing up in the post-9/11 world. So he tried to join the special forces. He had a problem, an accident, had to withdraw from that, eventually ended up in the CIA. So, this is someone who really wanted to join the system in order to protect it. So if he turns around 10 years later and he does what he does, then he does raise questions.
There is a quote, too, where he says he was exposed to so much disturbing material that was the beginning of when he felt compelled to come forward. And as you say, a real about face for someone who actually wanted to be part of the system.
Absolutely. And I think what is also very important in the story is that this is about not just a personal journey and something that in a way it feels almost like a metaphor of the United States coming out of this 10 years of war in which a number of compromises had to be made. And so all the moral questions that he's raising in a way, I think are questions that are familiar to many.
Questions are also going to be asked over how he actually got this information, because he wasn't a spy, he wasn't an analyst, he was a technical officer working on a contract term. There's going to be some serious questions raised by the way intelligence is protected within the CIA.
Absolutely, and I think actually that there's two levels of interpretation here. One is, as you said, the question of how you manage the sort of the protection of the information within the system. But I suppose also the other question, the other level is we have this new realm that is growing, right? The internet is becoming a major place where people's lives actually are unfolding. So how do we manage it? How do we draw a line? And I think this is also what is behind part of the questions that we're facing here in this country at the moment. How existing laws should meet the requirements of this fast evolving realm.
We'll be talking about this story for weeks and months to come, I imagine. Alessio, take us on to the next story you're looking at, this meeting between the two Koreas.
Absolutely. I think this is interesting because it started off as something relatively small. We know that the two Koreas had agreed to meet at Panmunjom, which is a heavily sort of armored border place, where besides the armistice was signed more than 60 years ago. And now they agreed actually to meet in Seoul and start looking at options for opening new channels of communication as it was just before when all the crisis started 2 months ago.
I find it quite fascinating because I think people looking on the outside would go, here we go again. The North is just doing the same cycle of what it's always been doing. And you could argue that in a sense, Kim Jong-un and his government has essentially won in a way because they've gotten the South Koreans to come back to the bargaining table.
Well, you see, this is one of those things that it's almost it's impossible to avoid. First of all, you're absolutely right. The question of the timing raises an element of suspicion there because people do wonder, is it really the North Koreans wanted to talk to everybody else, or it is because Xi Jinping and President of Burma were meeting, and the one point where they both agreed quite strongly, or at least that's what we know, was North Korea. So there's that type of question. On the other hand, when the North Koreans come around and say, like, well, you know, let's have a chat, you don't really say no, do you?
Well, we don't know who's coming from North Korea, do we? I mean, they're keeping that under wraps as well. How is that helpful in any way? Or are the South Koreans fairly used to it at this point?
Well, I think that's definitely one of the sort of element, one of the limitations. However, given also where they're coming from, it is not entirely surprising. What is interesting, however, is that they're starting to talk about a wide range of topics. Again, I think this is a 50-50 chance. You can always look at this type of situation with a very cynical eye and say, like, well, you know, not really. Or you could try to be positive. And I think in this kind of situation, because of North Korea, because of what happened over the past 3 months, you can't just turn a blind eye to the situation.
Because you mentioned the meeting that happened just this past weekend between Xi Jinping and Obama and the timing there. Was there a real sense that China is just getting fed up with North Korea and they're really putting a lot of pressure now on the North Koreans and Kim Jong-un to, in a sense, get their house in order and get in line?
Well, I think that there is a growing pressure. I think it is a pretty coherent message that is coming across from Chinese academics, senior officials. Now, pressure is true, but I think what the North Koreans really want to try to avoid is to lose that one last strong sort of supporter that they've had for many, many years. And so what they're trying to do is really to meet this sort of minimum threshold of behavior, so not to make the situation too unbearable for them.
I want to move on to the next story because you mentioned the young male population in China eyeing the fancy car market. And it's not just men. Women,
well,
too.
Absolutely, yes. In fact, it was, you know, when I would, let me put it this way. When you read the heading, it doesn't really suggest what it is in there, because what I find striking is that in reality, it's just a young sort of market. You know, it's youngsters
young,
that are after
new money,
exactly.
aspirational.
And it's interesting that very important British, you know, sort of luxury car makers, they find that the Chinese market has this lot of customized requirements for their cars. Not all of them probably would fancy, but it is interesting nonetheless.
And there is a fascinating graphic here as well, saying currently this year there's about 90 million vehicles in China. That number will almost double to 145 million in 2015. So a staggering increase there really shows the power of China's growing middle class.
Absolutely. Well, I'm not necessarily sure. I think it's really upper, you know, it's sort of upper end of the middle class, if not.
We are talking about Rolls Royces,
yes,
and Bentleys.
Yes,
okay.
No, absolutely. So we're talking about sort of the high end of the spectrum here in terms of car manufacturing. And this is terrific in a way, because this is a country country that is changing is a country, we understand now, where youngsters are developing their taste, they're becoming more sophisticated. So I don't know if this is just, you know, something like fancy to read about, or actually there are seeds of a different sort of future to come around, one that we didn't see for the past 10 years.
Alessio Petalano from the Department of War Studies at King's College, thanks so much for coming to the studio today.
Coming up next, we're in Istanbul for the latest on Turkey's protests as Prime Minister Erdogan had enough.
For centuries, Sulaymaniye has been a magnet for artists. On assignment in northern Iraq, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield met with would-be hip-hop artists, painters and poets to discover the city's new creative wave.
Kurdistan exists, and yet it doesn't. It's a country, and yet it isn't. It has a soul, though, and a culture, and that's a start. And if that soul, that culture, is to be found anywhere, it is found here in Sulaymaniye, a city of more than a million in the northeast of Iraq.
The Soul of Sulaymaniye, a photographic essay on Monocle.com.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 10:16. If you are in Istanbul, it is 8:16 here in London. Now, tens of thousands of protesters once again filled squares across Turkey, the ninth straight day since anger first erupted on the streets. In Istanbul's Taksim Square, there was a festive mood, while in Ankara, police used tear gas to disperse protesters. Turks across the country have been protesting Prime Minister Erdogan's rule, many saying their secular government is under threat.
Well, Erdogan responded to those calls over the weekend by holding six rallies with his supporters. He also rejected calls for his resignation, saying that his patience with anti-government protesters would soon be running out. It is setting up a battle between two very different camps in Turkey, the more conservative branch and those wanting to continue with the country's open liberal system. Well, joining us now on the line from Istanbul is Gülseren Ulcum, a Turkish-German reporter. Very warm welcome to you, Gülseren.
Hi.
Well, Erdogan is back in town now. Tell us how that's changed the situation.
Well, yeah, Erdogan came back on Friday and made an impromptu speech at the airport at 2 a.m. and they shipped people, AKP supporters, to the airport. There were several thousands there. The situation and the atmosphere was pretty intense at the beginning. And Erdogan made clear, look, we're going to continue with Gezi Park no matter what. The protests are illegal and we're going to continue with our steps. The situation is very intense and he continued making various speeches over the weekend. Especially in Ankara, he holds six different speeches in six different places. And people are kind of expecting what's going on. There are a lot of rumors going on right now.
And Gülseren, there were, as you mentioned, protesters and supporters on both sides of the argument. You actually met up with several of them and had a few words with them.
Exactly. So I met Tamer, who is an AKP supporter from the first time. He gave all his three votes in the last three elections to Erdogan and the AKP, and he's a fan of his policies. And so I met him. He's 32 years old and he's from Istanbul.
It was the first time that people came together, fighting against a power. Well, on the one hand, I'm sad because this is a protest against the government I'm voting for. But on the other hand, people managed to come together and realize that they are not as different as they thought. Football groups, fanatic groups came together and were protesting arm in arm. And now politicians and NGOs, and we have to keep this brotherhood and that we are not different from each other. This is something important, and politicians should make the most out of this.
Bu güzel bir şey yani. Bunu iyi değerlendirmesi gerekiyor herkesin. Özellikle politikacıların.
During the weekend, the situation calmed down and settled, actually. Before, it was expected that people will leave Gezi Park soon. They said, how long can people stay over there? But the group over there showed that more and more people are coming. The organization got better and better, and it showed that people can live peaceful together as long as there is no assault.
Geçtiğimiz haftadan sonra, Gezi Parkı'na girilmesinden sonra, bence...
Since last week, Gezi Park seems to be back in the hand of the initial protesters. There was later on the GHP, the Kemalist Nationalist Party, the TGB, Turkey Youth Union, but later it made clear that they are there only as guests, and the Gezi Park was left to the youth and apolitical people again, and this weekend showed this clearly.
Onların biraz daha oranın hakimiyetinde olduklarının belli olduğu bir hafta sonuydu.
Gülseren, just two of the protesters and supporters that you spoke with there in Istanbul. One of the questions they asked was, how long will people stay? Is there a growing sense there on the streets of Istanbul that people will stay until Prime Minister Erdogan, many not expecting his resignation, but they're at least asking for it?
Well, the atmosphere right now is that they will definitely stay. Yesterday, for example, hundreds of thousands of people were going to Taksim Square to join the protest. The Taksim Resistance Group was holding an announcement saying, look, we are expecting this from our prime minister, and as long as this is not fulfilled, we are not leaving. On the other hand, there are a few rumors going on that Erdogan apparently set a deadline, but none of this is confirmed, so the situation might change. So on the one hand, the people are quite concerned and excited what will happen next. On the other hand, they say, we're going to stay here no matter what.
Gülseren, I mean, Erdogan says he's going to continue with the redevelopment. So are we getting to a point where he's just going to have to physically push them off the land?
Well, that's what people are afraid of. So, but on the other hand, the Istanbul place is very unique, so that the police step back, that's actually very, very unique, and very people can't really understand why this happened. Police is nowhere, only civil police, but the crashes in other cities continue. So there might be something going on, and there might be police intervention, but no one knows. And it really depends on how Erdogan kind of continues and what he's going to say. According to his speeches yesterday, it seems like he really wants to take back Gezi Park. But as I said, nothing is really confirmed and his next steps are not really open.
And many people asking the question, where are the leaders in Turkey's opposition parties? They seem to have been relatively quiet through all of this. Can you give us some more information on that?
Well, I think some of the opposition parties tried to overtake the protest and make it as an opposition thing, but the protests were very sensitive in this sense and said, look, this is not an opposition movement just against the AKP, or it's not the political movement. It has more. It's about the authoritarian government style of Erdogan. There are a few things which are not going well, and we want to solve this, and we don't want to be politicized by any opposition party. So last week, Saturday, the opposition party tried to make a meeting in Taksim, but it wasn't really successful because people are very sensitive. On the other hand, the BDP, the Kurdish party, joined the protests this weekend. And I think this was because at the same time there are very important peace negotiations with the Kurds and the Turkish government. So they don't want to endanger this peace talk because it's very unique and it's very new. So that might be one reason they were not joining as officially as we might hear.
Excellent stuff, Gülseren. Many thanks for your time. That was Gülseren Ulcum, a Turkish-German reporter there in Istanbul.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich,
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Do you think you could ditch your BlackBerry and modern luxuries and submit yourself to complete solitude for a total of 6 months?
No.
One of the first questions you might ask yourself is, why on earth would you want to do such a thing? Or why didn't I bring my iPad? Well, one man has decided to do just that and left the big city lights for a remote forest in Baikal, Siberia.
Sylvain Tesson challenged himself to disconnect from the modern world and spent a total of 6 months in complete isolation, although he did bring along his dog for some company. Well, the book titled Consolations of the Forest is out now, and I caught up with Sylvain a little earlier.
I settled myself in a little cabin in the west shore of Baikal Lake, which is this huge and very remote lake on the south of Siberia, not very far away from the Mongolian border. And I decided to settle myself, to immerse myself in the middle of the wilderness in this cabin, which was more than 5 days walking from the nearest village, and with a very, very seldom neighborhood, because my first neighbor was at 25 kilometers walking from my hut.
When you hear this at first, you can just say, you know, I could see maybe someone doing it for a couple of days, maybe a few weeks. But how on earth was it possible to last 6 months?
Well, of course, the time I decided to devolute to the loneliness and to be still on my cabin was very important. It was very important for me to last 6 months because I wanted to tame the time. I wanted to invent a new relation with the time. For me, the time, I was upset, by the way, that the time is escaping, is leaking in front of us. And I thought if I was settling in the middle of nowhere with nothing to do, just thinking and just looking at the landscape, I would appreciate that the time is going a little bit slower. And it was a fact. It works indeed.
Well, you say just now you wanted to invent a new relationship with time. After 6 months, do you think you were able to create that relationship?
Yes, because I decided to organize my day in a few parts. During the morning time, I was reading, I was thinking, I was meditating, I was looking through the window, I was smoking, I was devoting my time to the spirit activities. And on the afternoon, I was much more outside, shoveling the snow, drilling the ice, fishing, and rambling around my hut. And so this organization of my day was really a way to make a new relationship with the time. And it was a very nice thing to be aware that when you are in the middle of the forest, you are living a very simple life, a very sober life, opposite to our urban life, which is very complicated. And this very simple life made the time become much more calm.
A very simple life, a very sober life, but also, from the book, a very quiet life. Much of the time was spent in complete silence. And you ask the question, because it's in those moments when you can really try to answer the question, is it even possible to live with yourself?
Well, that was a big challenge for me. Was I able to live for 6 months with myself? You know, when we are in the city, we are surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of our friends, of our relationship, working relationship, so that you are never in front of yourself in the silence. And this silence is sometimes very upsetting because you don't know what is inside yourself, and you never devote time to explore the inside of yourself. So I had 6 months of this, like a desert, like if you are entering in the Sahara desert. As I did not trust myself and my own internal resources, I decided to bring some books. I had 80 books from philosophy to poetry, from novel to some political essay, because I knew that maybe I would need reading just to fill up my inspiration and my internal life.
And I think also one of the hardest and perhaps most emotionally challenging parts of your 6 month stay was when you found out your relationship with your girlfriend ended and you were, of course, stuck in the middle of nowhere.
Yes, well, that was a very big shock for me, but I made the mistake to take a satellite phone, and this bad news came through this little concession I did to the civilization. I should have been much more radical, and I should avoid to bring in the woods this devil telephone. if I avoid to take it, I would not have this bad news, you know. I think the silence is very good also, because nothing comes through the silence and nothing is breaking your certitude that everything is okay.
But obviously everything wasn't okay, because you just got your heart broken. How did you manage to deal with yourself in that situation? Obviously your emotions are completely amplified.
Well, of course it was amplified by the loneliness and by the very dramatic character of the landscape. But I think if I did not have my dogs, I had two dogs who really helped me to go through this bad time. Of course, it seems a little bit ridiculous when you say that when you are coming back in Paris and when you are talking to a British journalist and you say, my dogs saved me. It looks like a little bit, you know, romantic, a little bit fleur bleue, we say in French, which means a little bit ridiculous, you know. But it was really the reality when I was in this sad time. If I did not have the opportunity to go in the wood with my dogs and to try to forget this, I would never survive, I think.
Well, I guess that's why they say dogs are a man's best friend. I guess the big question, though, after your experience is, would you do something like this again? Maybe not right away, but perhaps in 10, 20 years to really, I guess, try to gain a bit more perspective on life.
Yes, of course, I am absolutely sure. That's why I called the book The Consolation of the Forest. I think that the way to be still and to be loneliness is a very big consolation to the sadness. And I am sure that the three goods I experimented during my stay in the woods, which are the loneliness, the silence, and the cold weather, will be some tomorrow luxury goods. In 20 years, we will consider that to be alone and to be in the silence and to be in cold weather is much more luxury than to be in a golden palace, you know. So I am sure I will, of course, repeat again this experience. But maybe, as you said, it will not be exactly in the same natural countryside. Maybe it would be in the desert. Maybe it would be in much more a mountain landscape. But for sure, I will experiment again the loneliness.
And that was me speaking to Sylvain Tesson, author of Consolations of the Forest. And Poppy, you actually just said his name actually means something very interesting.
Sylvain means wooded. I grew up in a place called Sylvan Valley, Wooded Valley.
Weird. What a coincidence.
He was meant to do this, meant to write that. In the next half hour of the program, we preview what thousands of avid festival goers can look forward to at Barcelona's 20th Sonar Music Festival. But first, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you. A former CIA employee has been explaining why he leaked details of a top-secret US surveillance program to the newspapers. 29-year-old whistleblower Edward Snowden said he was acting out of conscience to protect what he called basic liberties for people around the world. He's been working as a contractor at the US National Security Agency and released details of an NSA program codenamed PRISM. Revelations that it was used to gather millions of phone records and monitored internet data have caused concern about intrusion. Afghan security forces have fought off a major attack on the international airport in Kabul, which also houses an international military base. Seven militants were killed after a dawn raid. The first high-level meeting between officials from North and South Korea for 6 years has been confirmed. The talks are set to take place in Seoul on Wednesday and Thursday this week. Officials in Hungary say flood defences put in place over the weekend appear to have held off a surge in the level of the Danube in the capital, Budapest. There have been concern about flooding similar to that seen across much of Central Europe over the last week. At least 15 people have died in the floods. Prayers have been said across South Africa for former President Nelson Mandela, who spent a third night in hospital with a recurring lung infection. The 94-year-old was taken to hospital early on Saturday. It's his fourth hospital stay since December, and there's been no official update on his condition since the government said on Saturday he was in a serious condition. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Poppy Trowbridge, and Phil Hahn. Time now to get a roundup of the news on the ground from our man in Nairobi. Tristan McConnell is the man there, and he's on the line.
Welcome to the show, Tristan. Let's begin with some developments coming out of South Sudan.
Sure. Well, what's going on there at the moment is it's all rather depressing. We've seen this kind of thing before. Basically, the government in Khartoum in the north is accusing South Sudan of backing rebels along its border and has threatened to cut off the oil supplies once again. Now, you may remember that in January last year, South Sudan stopped the oil being pumped from its oil fields through the northern pipelines to the export ports in the north. Now, this time around, it's Khartoum who's threatening to cut it off, saying that South Sudan is supporting rebels who are destabilizing areas along the border, and that they've now decided to give them 60 days in which to stop that support, or else they're going to stop the oil themselves. Now, of course, the implications of that is very serious for both North and South. The South is almost completely dependent on oil revenues for its government income, and the North as well is heavily dependent. So it's bad news for both sides.
Tristan, what have been the real effects on the ground of this reduced supply in oil, or at least the threat? I mean, how's it changing people's lives in business and at home?
Sure. Well, I think it's worrying people because, you know, we've seen what happens when the oil is shut down. Like I said, it was shut down in January last year, and that lasted for 16 months. And it really crippled the economies of both North and South. Now, the South seems, in a way, slightly more able to deal with such economic hardship because, you know, they've come out of a couple of decades of civil war during which there really was no economic development. So for some down there, you know, it's a kind of feeling of, well, we've been through this before, we can cope. The problem that the North faces is that they've seen a great deal of economic growth in recent years despite Western sanctions because of the ability to export oil and make money from that. So Khartoum has grown massively. So they really feel the pinch when the oil revenue stops. So when we get these kinds of threats, which in this case may or may not be followed through on, but we have seen it been followed through on before, it's really a kind of mutual suicide, economic suicide by North and South. But it seems to be a chip that both sides are willing to play at the table when it comes to negotiating over their future.
And Tristan, you were actually in one of the rebel-held areas just a couple weeks ago. Can you give us a sense of the situation in those areas which you visited?
Yeah, I was in an area called South Kordofan, perhaps better known as the Nuba Mountains, which is part of that state. Now, when Khartoum says that the South is backing rebels, what they're really talking about is a group called the Sudan Revolutionary Front, and they're the ones who kind of control the area that I was in a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, for my own investigations and that of analysts who've been up there to look into these allegations of arms flows, it's very hard to see any hard evidence for Khartoum's allegations. And when they come out with these sorts of statements that the South is backing rebels in North Sudan, they never actually provide any evidence. And thus far, they're really isn't much. I mean, certainly there's kind of political support, and certainly the rebels used to be allied with the South. But if you look for hard evidence of weapons flows, for example, across the border from South to North, there is none. Not that I've seen and not that people I speak to have seen. The situation in the rebel-held areas themselves, it's pretty serious. I mean, look, malnutrition, food shortages are perennial, but they are that much worse when there's a war going on. And the impact of the war on the ground is pretty horrendous. I mean, it takes the form of aerial bombardment by Khartoum's air force, and that is fairly indiscriminate and, you know, causes a lot of casualties among particularly children and civilians.
Tristan, tell us about how this port town of Kismayo is also experiencing conflict, just very briefly.
Yeah, that's another worrying turn of events. I mean, Kismayo in southern Somalia is really the heart of the southern economy. There's a very lucrative charcoal trade. There's potential oil and gas deposits offshore, and there's fertile farming land. And so there's a lot of economic benefits to be fought over. And what we're seeing right now in Kismayo over the weekend, when a couple of dozen people have been killed in these kind of clan-based shootouts, is a kind of return to really the problems that triggered the last 20 odd years of civil war in Somalia, which is clan militias fighting over resources. And a resurgence of that kind of conflict in Kismayo really does, you know, threaten all the good progress that Somalia has made over the last couple of years.
And finally, Tristan, all eyes positioned on South Africa, many people watching whether Nelson Mandela will be able to recover from a lung infection.
Yeah, and this is, you know, he's a terribly old man, but so we shouldn't be that surprised that he's, you know, having these illnesses and in hospital. But you simply cannot understate his importance, you know, to South Africa especially, but also to the entire continent and, for that matter, to the world. I mean, there really is no other figure quite like him in Africa in terms of his ability to unify people and to sort of stand for a kind of singular kind of good morality. He is not a mixed figure to people in Africa. He's a great man who did wonderful things in terms of, you know, freeing black people from apartheid. And you know, his illness is something that worries everyone. And certainly the potential that he may die sometime soon is something that will, you know, cause grieving across the entire continent, and rightly so.
Tristan McConnell there in Nairobi. Many thanks for your time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this to head to Barcelona's Sonar Music Festival.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
When it comes to retail, the Taiwanese capital's independent shops are increasingly worthy of attention. Monocle's filmmaker wandered down side streets to discover a myriad of new small shops, each with a concept totally their own.
The name for the Pinmo Pure Store came to founder Richard Wong in a dream. It too is a hybrid, a tiny space on a residential street in the Daan district that carries paper goods and clothing. A design agency shares the space, and tea and cookies are available even though there's no space to sit down.
Changing the city's retail landscape, one little shop at a time. Taipei Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:41 here in London. Now, for a preview of this week's culture with Rob Bound, we're heading to Spain. This week, thousands upon thousands of avid festival-goers will converge on Barcelona for the Sonar Music Festival. Billed as the world's premier advanced music and media arts festival, this year marks its 20th edition, giving the crowds and organizers more than enough reason to celebrate under the sun. And frankly, into the night, of course.
And they're not holding back for the celebration. With a 12% increase in budget, capacity, and even a new location for Sonar by day. Our Liam Aldis talked to co-director Enrique Palot about the changes, the secret to their longevity, and how they've managed to stay at the cutting edge of what is increasingly a crowded festival circuit. Oh, and he may have also snuck in a few questions about some of the antics backstage as well.
Twenty years is a long time in the festival circuit. How have you managed to get this far?
Well, it's a long way, but here we are. We started 2 years preparing the project from 92 to 94. Then we started as a very small festival. I think we achieved from the very beginning to be this global platform and meeting point for artists, audience, and media, and industry around creativity and technology. And this is still the main concept of our festival. We've been moving ahead. There's been a huge evolution in the format of the festival, in the contents itself, and always on the way that how technology has been advancing and moving on all these years. You know, I mean, as we were explaining before, 94 internet didn't exist. So we were doing experimental shows with people using internet, artists using internet in 1995. Now the experimentation is going to be this time with mobility, with people using, you know, laptops, tablets, iPhones. This is going to be one of the main things and one of the main theme this year at the festival on the use of technology. But the main goal, the main thing of ourselves working in this festival is reach and research for the newest talent all over the world, you know. And this is going to be the one that is going to be more visible. And I think it's the aspect where make Sonar more recognizable, and the aspect that's one of the reasons that a lot of people is coming to Sonar is actually to discover.
But how do you maintain the reputation of Sonar as the cutting-edge premier music festival? Do you go out there, are you scouring the globe every year looking for the fresh talent?
We move around, we travel, we try to do research. We have created our own network of people doing research with us in other places in the world. We watch what is happening, and then it's a big goal every year to build a festival. And this is we don't start by scratch, but we believe that we need to explain something different every year. So there's hard work on the way we build the different contents. I mean, the lineups and the other activities around the festival, and the way we present this, the way all the production is made, why this show is going to be before this other one or after. This is like a film, you know. We want to tell a story once a year for 3 days in Barcelona for all these music lovers and technology lovers that are coming to visit the festival.
What about the sonars in Iceland and in Japan? How do they fit into the sonar puzzle?
It's very exciting. We've been moving around the world now in 40 cities since 2002. And Reykjavik was the new one this year. Very, very good. I mean, half of the lineup was Icelandic artists. Enormous talent, amazing musicians. We bring four of them to the festival: Laffer Arnolds, Gluteus Maximum. Especially, I want to recommend to the people to check CZI, which is an amazing female vocal house band that will play in the new stage of Sonar Village. So these places like Reykjavik, Tokyo, are very good for us to reach new artists, new talent coming from these countries. Also, is a trip that we started this year with 9 cities in North America, the US and Canada, and then Reykjavik and Tokyo. It's something that at the end of this circuit, there's always Barcelona.
You've decided to go a little larger this year for the 20th anniversary, and you're moving to the Fira Montjuic.
Yeah.
What can we expect?
It's time to change. We want to force ourselves to be able to go to a new place, to think on new ideas, and new perspective, new ways to present the contents and activity of the festival. What people will find is a place where circulation between stages and activities is going to be easier. You know, we had some capacity problems in the venue where we were until now. I think the look of the shows, the quality of the shows are going to be better, because we are going to, some of the spaces are going to be bigger. We have for the first time a seated auditorium for 1,000 people, which we never had before. So I think it opens a new bunch of possibilities for the festival to grow, but also to think on the other way some of the activities we've been doing all these years.
It's been 20 years, so obviously you've dealt with hundreds of artists over those 20 years. Who has been the most memorable?
Being on the last show of LCD Sound System on the main stage and James Murphy saying thanks to the festival, it's been one of my moments, because you know it's very hard to build all of this, so it's great that James was saying thanks to all of us and the audience that was having in front of him. Masters at Work playing an amazing set in the main stage and having the sensation that I was sitting in my sofa with an amazing hi-fi system. The quality, the sound quality of that show was absolutely amazing for me. I don't know, I probably would have 100 examples of memorable moments for personally at the festival. I just remember a few ones now.
Well, I have to ask this as well, who's been the most troublesome? Because I'm sure you've had to deal with a lot of big personalities over the years as well.
Yeah. The Bad Crystal Castles they basically killed their shows. I don't know what they wanted to do, but they turned that show on an unpleasant show, and I think they made the audience very, very angry, which I think is very unrespectful.
How so?
You know, they were kind of messing around and throwing things to the audience, stopping the show after 15 minutes. So let's forget about the bad one. The good one is Miss Grace Jones, that made us wait for quite a long until she won on stage. So everything, all the preparations were kind of tough before, during and after. But this is the good one because she went on stage and she played an amazing show. So all the suffering that we have, that people don't see, and we have it as an organization, it makes always sense when then the show or the artist is delivering to the festival and the audience, it's good and positive. So I'm not complaining.
So I guess the lesson is, if they're going to cause you a headache, just it's okay as long as the headache stops when they're on stage.
Exactly, yeah.
Grace Jones is worth it. That was co-director of Sonar Music Festival, Enric Palau, speaking to Monocle's Liam Aldous for this week's edition of Culture with Robert Bound, which you can catch tonight at 1900 London time.
And before our Brazilian newspaper review, we have a Brazilian song that celebrates Festus Junina, a typical folksy festival that is widely celebrated in the country in the month of June. This is Gal Costa with Festa do Interior. The very upbeat Gal Costa there with Festa do Interior, and I have to admit our producer Alijan was doing quite a few spectacular dance moves. It was really quite a sight to behold.
I think you call it the two-step. You're listening to Midori House with me, Poppy Trowbridge, and Felhan. We're joined now by Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco to take a look at some of the Brazilian newspaper headlines. Welcome.
Hello, good morning. Did you enjoy the It's Upbeat song in the morning? It's lovely, no?
Put some life into us, that's for sure. What's the first story you're looking at?
Shall we start? Well, Folha de São Paulo, they just released the latest opinion polls for next year's election for president and state governors. And it's quite interesting. So shall we start with the presidential one? Dilma Rousseff, she's still the favorite to win with 51%. But I have to say that she's at the same time at all-time low because the Brazilian economy is not as good as it was right now. And we have the inflation is rising. We've been having some problems with violence and safety. But she's still there with 51%. A month ago, she had like 58%. But, you know, she's still the favorite to win.
And all eyes still people expecting that Dilma will come away as the winner next year.
Exactly. If nothing goes wrong, of course. But of course, we're going to have all this positive vibe from the World Cup next year as well. So she's going to, I think it would be good for her. And also in second place is Marina Silva, which she used to be a member of the Green Party. She used to be the leader of the Green Party. But now she's creating a new political party, the Rede Sustentabilidade. Oh my God, even I have problems saying this Portuguese word. Rede Sustentabilidade. And she had 16%, and she's quite well known among Brazilians. Even though she's currently creating, the political party is not there yet, but I'm pretty sure until next year it will be there.
So it's not too late for her to start a political party this close to an election?
No, not at all, not at all.
Will she take politicians from other parties to make her a new party, or
yeah,
is it going to be a bunch of newcomers?
Well, there'll be a bunch of newcomers, but she's been approaching some other political MPs from other political parties across the political spectrum.
And what's been the main issues for this campaign? Has it been the economy?
Absolutely, the economy and inflation, which is quite high at the moment in Brazil. I mean, not as it used to be in the 90s, which we have a terrible crisis of hyperinflation. But yeah, Brazilians and our economy is being a bit sluggish at the moment. So we don't grow. For example, I think other Latin American countries like Mexico or Colombia, they're growing much more than Brazil. So I think Dilma will have to be kind of worried about that.
What kind of promises is she making? The criticism of her is that she's just run out of options.
Exactly. And she doesn't change the political economy since her government starts. So, yes, you're right. I mean, she's just running out of options. And so that's...
And another survey has been released by Folha de São Paulo, this time about São Paulo governor.
Exactly, which is Geraldo Alckmin, and he's from the opposition party PSDB, and he would be easily re-elected with 52%, and it's interesting to say, because again, I was talking about violence, because São Paulo did improve their violence rates in the last 10 years, but in the last year or so, the violence has been increasing again, and there's been quite a lot of protests against that, but it's interesting that he's still the favorite to win, so I would say he's kind of the Teflon candidate, you know, that no no matter what happened, he's
still coming back.
And even if Lula, because there's been some rumors that Lula, our previous president, might be the candidate to be a São Paulo governor, even if Lula would be candidate as well, Geraldo Alckmin would still win. So that's quite
interesting. Fernando, you said it yourself just a minute ago. Football is always on the front page. What's the next story you've got here?
We can't escape from that. Well, actually, I'm fairly happy, you know, because as you can see on the front page here of O Globo, the Brazilians are very happy. We beat France yesterday in another...
For the first time in many years.
Exactly, in 20 years. We have some sort of trauma when we play against France. There was this iconic final of the World Cup in 98 where we lost to France 3-0. But actually, that was a friendly. It was in the Porto Alegre, in the south of Brazil. And this is kind of just, again, more preparation for the Confederations Cup, which is starting on Saturday, my birthday.
Which is your birthday, I hear.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is in itself preparation for the World Cup. Is that how people are looking at it?
Of course.
Building momentum.
And, you know, I was talking to some friends as well. I know this event is not hugely important, but it's a good test to see if a country, if the stadiums are ready, if all the infrastructure is kind of there. So, yeah, I think all Brazilians are kind of excited for that.
Because we still
and the coverage, it's...
We have still seen a lot of horror stories about the stadiums and the venues for the World Cup and for the Olympics that just aren't ready yet, and they're going to remain closed until next year.
Probably until the day before the match. But, you know, in the end, it's going to be fine. But, yeah, so the Confederation starts this Saturday.
And who do you think will win the tournament? I'm guessing.
I think Brazil might win.
Excellent. Well, we have lots to look forward to. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, many thanks for having a flick through this morning's Brazilian front pages. But unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to our producer, the very talented dancer, Ala John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and James Bullock, and our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is the latest edition of The Urbanist, presented by Andrew Tuck. I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds from Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for me, Phil Hahn...
And me, Poppy Trowbridge.
It's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.